So, quiz, can you guess what Jesus' first words are in John's gospel? No takers? It's all good. The other words, what are you seeking? What are you seeking? We see them back in John chapter 1, verse 38, and it's the question that Jesus asked two men at the proclamation of John the Baptist, who points to Jesus and says, "Behold, the Lamb of God." And these two men who were disciples of John the Baptist, they decide to follow Jesus. And so Jesus, he turns and he sees these two men following him, and he asks them, "What are you seeking?" And we could say that this has been the question for every person who's seen or beheld something about Jesus and then decided to follow him. What are you seeking? It's an introspective question. Because in their looking at Jesus, Jesus actually turns them back to looking within themselves, almost as if to ask them, where do you think this is going? What is it or who is it that you are actually following? What are you seeking? It's now the question that Jesus will ask in an entirely different context in John chapter 18 by the authorities as they're trying to arrest them, as they're trying to arrest Jesus. But it's still a question that everyone who encounters Jesus will have to answer. And how we answer this question of what are you seeking has significant implications for our lives. It speaks the loudest to who we are, what our hope is, and what we are willing to do to pursue and preserve that hope. What are you seeking? Again, this isn't just a question for first-time followers of Jesus to ask themselves in a way that counts the cost of following him. No, this is also a question for the long-time follower of Jesus, for the person who is nearest and closest to him. Proximity to Jesus doesn't mean that our answer to this question is always rooted in the right motives. The example is that today we're actually looking at two men who probably spent every single day of their lives for 3 years with Jesus. They entered into his closest circles. They earned his trust. And yet both of them are exposed to have been seeking different things, meaning that they misunderstood Jesus. They formed a perspective about Jesus to where they thought he was something that he wasn't. And they acted on that, even in their seeking Jesus. So what are you seeking? What are you seeking, brothers and sisters? In following Jesus, what are you seeking? Are you seeking truth? An elevated status? A suffering-free existence? Morality, being on the right side of history? Success? The list could go on. Whatever it is that we're seeking might not necessarily be a bad thing. That's most likely the case with Judas and Peter. Neither of these men were villainous in the traditional sense that they were following Jesus from purely evil motives. You would have never thought that they'd do what they do here in John chapter 18. Their affections and their desires, although they weren't hidden from Jesus because he knows exactly who they are, they flew largely beneath the surface in the presence of others, in the presence of the other disciples. We know that Judas, he had the money, he held the money bag, but only later do we find out that he was somewhat of an embezzler, that he was greedy. And Peter, this was a man who displayed unflinching loyalty to Jesus. These weren't bad guys with malicious motives and intentions. But what we see happens is that when it finally comes down to Jesus' mission, loss, death, suffering, his mission to suffer and die, that mission, the person and work of Jesus, converges with their aims and their pursuits, and it exposes them. It exposes them so that they can see what's really within themselves. So for us, brothers and sisters, although we may not deny or betray Jesus in the manner that these men did, when Jesus' person and his work and his mission, when it converges with us, it'll expose our true motives as well. It'll expose what we are really seeking. That's Jesus' style. That's what he does all throughout this gospel. With every single, almost every single interaction, he goes straight for the desires and the aims and the pursuits of the people that he talks to. Think about Nicodemus. He goes straight for the scriptures. This was a man who was supposed to know the scriptures and the way to God. And Jesus says, how do you not know this? The Samaritan woman at the well. He goes straight for her trusting and looking for security and satisfaction in marriages. The lame man in John 5, Jesus goes straight for his shiftiness. Even in his looking to be made well, he's constantly trying to preserve and defend himself, which is why he tells on Jesus later. When Jesus encounters us, when his mission intersects with our aims and our wills and our lives, he comes for that which is most precious and valuable to us. And when he does, you and I are left with the decision. When we encounter him, he gives us a choice to follow him or to trust ourselves. The question is, will we follow him down a path that's not our own? Will we lean into Jesus' will and his way, even when it means suffering and loss and death, dying to ourselves, denying ourselves? When Jesus converges with your deepest hopes and your motives and your desires, how will you respond? So let's look at chapter 18. Chapter 18 turns from teaching and prayer, this prayer of Jesus in John 17, back into narrative. So what we're going to do is that today we're just going to walk through the story and then touch down on a few places that largely revolve around these two disciples, Judas and Peter. First thing that we'll see is Judas converges with Jesus and encounters Jesus and flees from him by betraying him. The second thing that we'll see here is that Peter converges and encounters with Jesus by trying to fight for him and defend him and to keep him from something. Judas flees, Peter fights. Typical fight or flight syndrome, right? And what we see here is that neither response comes from faith in Jesus and actually seeing him and believing him for who he is, he says he is. Both of these responses come from a place of self-preservation. So remember in John chapter 17, Jesus has just prayed to the Father in the presence of his disciples, making known all the things that he's done for them during his ministry. And then he also asked the Father to do some things for them when he's gone. We saw in John 17 how the Godhead brings so much more to the table, almost everything to the table in saving us and keeping us than we ever could. We just respond by believing him and trusting him, keeping his commandments. We see that the Godhead brings all of this to the table because left to ourselves, the disciples left to themselves, we could never keep ourselves. He must hold us fast because we would let go. Jesus' disciples and us, we're going to need God for us and with us in keeping us because there's so many moments when we'll fail to keep ourselves. And as we look and jump into John chapter 18, that's exactly what happens with the disciples. They will all flee and abandon Jesus after this moment. And so let's look at verse 1 and see how Judas flees from Jesus by betraying him. Verse 1, when Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the brook Kidron, where there was a garden, what we know as the Garden of Gethsemane, where he and his disciples entered. Now Judas, who we see, enters back into the scene after he left the place where Jesus and his disciples were eating back in John chapter 13. Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. If there's anything that John wants us to know about this man, Judas, it's that he betrays Jesus. All the way from John chapter 6 and even John chapter 13 and on, every time he brings up Judas, this is Jesus's betrayer. He says it in verse 2 and again in verse 5 here in chapter 18. And this isn't a surprise to Jesus or to John. You remember back in chapter 13, Jesus told his followers that one of them would betray him. And then, after Peter quietly asked John who it would be, John finds out from Jesus that it was going to be Judas, the person who he would give this morsel of bread, Jesus said. And John said at that moment, when Jesus turns to Judas and says, "Do what you need to do quickly," John says that Satan entered into Judas. Judas, who everyone thought was going out to buy supplies or to give money to the poor, he was actually selling Jesus for a few hundred bucks, 30 pieces of silver. So now, after claiming his reward, Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. The hour of betrayal has come. But let's slow up. How does Judas get here? How does Judas get here from bursar to betrayer? Certainly, yes, something satanic is going on within him, around him. But ultimately, Judas puts himself in this position because when his interests converge with Jesus' will and Jesus' interests, Judas refuses to submit to Jesus' way. We don't know how in particular it happened or exactly how it happened necessarily, but all the clues are there in this gospel. Just like the rest of the other disciples, Judas most likely had an understanding of this man Jesus that assumed that Jesus' trajectory would lead to earthly power or to kingship or prominence. So as the guy who's been entrusted to keep the books, Judas is counting the money that comes along with that power and prominence that Jesus has assumed for himself by the things that he's doing in his life and his ministry. And Judas knew firsthand that fame brings money and money secures power, and he was probably after the accumulation of both of these things. But you look back at John chapter 12, but when Jesus showed no interest, right, in preserving this really expensive gift that was given to him, this gift of ointment that was poured out on his feet by Mary, the sister of Lazarus. When she cracks that jar and pours it out on Jesus, that expensive jar, which could have provided so many resources and things, money for the poor, continued prominence and accumulation of fame for Jesus, when she cracks that jar, Judas just doesn't know what to do. So he disguises his greed in the language of concern for the poor and the marginalized. But in that moment, Judas was probably more frustrated with what Jesus said the act represented. You remember this? Preparation for his death. Wait, what? His death? Death? Jesus, you're the leading revolutionary, the top political figure in society right now. How are you going to die? What does any of this mean if you die, Jesus? For your burial in the tomb, this has an end date? No, death is weakness. Death is defeat, not power. Where is all this going if you die? The authorities already want you. You're a criminal in their eyes, which means, in Judas' words, I'm a criminal. Now Judas is just ready to get off this train. It's headed to nowhere. Arrest, loss, maybe even his own death by association with Jesus. So better to cut his losses and take the bounty, right? Because there won't be any money left when Jesus is dead. We see that Judas loves money. Judas loves money, and Judas loves what money can give him. But overall, Judas loves Judas. And Judas loves Judas more than he loves Jesus. And so when Judas's plans converge and intersect with Jesus's, Judas is picking himself every single time. He won't follow Jesus into what he perceives is defeat and loss and death. That's how he ends up here. He's very so much human, just like the rest of us. Motives and desires and intentions are all at play. because he's a sinful individual. And so what Judas says here is that, Jesus, you will get arrested so that I won't be arrested. Jesus, you will die so that I won't. So here's Judas now, either organizing or directing this group of armed temple police and Roman soldiers to illegally arrest Jesus. Yes, this is an illegal action. You cannot just show up in somebody's spot without a charge or a warrant and say, you need to come with us. The illegality of their actions is cloaked in the darkness of the night. This wasn't regular form or practice. What we see here is that these aren't simply the sinful individual actions of a betrayer, but this, brothers and sisters, this is the introduction of a corrupt system that is actively complicit against Jesus in this moment. Why? Because Jesus is a threat to what they want and what they desire most. They will not have him be who he says he is. Because for them it means defeat and loss and a kind of death. And this is no surprise, brothers and sisters. This is what sinful humans do and have always responded and done, either to God or to each other when power or status is threatened. They conspire against Jesus. But this doesn't surprise Jesus. He doesn't need anyone to tell him about humanity. He's in control, which is why verse 4, Jesus says, Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, who do you seek? What are you looking for? Now, these words here, right, they bookend his ministry. And like several other statements that he's made throughout his ministry, these words, they carry within them a double meaning. I mean, what exactly are they looking for in this illegal arrest under the cover of night? What are they looking to accomplish and to achieve? Who is it that they think this man is that they respond in this way? They respond to the obvious and they say, we're looking for Jesus of Nazareth. And Jesus goes on with another double-edged response saying, I am. Now, our Bibles say, I am he. But his response there literally is, I am. Which causes them to draw back and to fall to the ground. Think about that for a second. That's exactly what happens. Now, these soldiers and policemen who came out against a peaceful rabbi, Jesus, with the equivalent of riot gear, they're forced to stagger back and fall down at his words, at the mere acknowledgement of who he is. But why does this happen? What's being shown to us through this event? Well, it all has to do with the statement that Jesus makes of, I am he. Jesus isn't just identifying himself here, but this is a name. This is a statement about who he is. It's a powerful name, a wonderful name. If you look back to the book of Exodus, I am, it is the covenantal name of God that he revealed to Moses and to his people. Tell them I am sent you. That I am is all powerful and will deliver his people. I am who I am. That's what Jesus means, and that's why it provokes and even causes this response. They must bow to this name. They must fall back at this name. So, brothers and sisters, this points to Jesus' divinity. That's who he is. Not a revolutionary, not a rabbi, not a good teacher, not just a carpenter. He is God. God the Son, sent into the world to save and rescue and deliver God's people. Not a messenger, God himself. He's greater than Moses. The I am actually shows up in the flesh on the scene. So who are they seeking? This wasn't who they were looking for. I can guarantee you that. This wasn't who they were looking for, but this is who they got. They came for Jesus of Nazareth, a Jewish carpenter, a rabbi. But these soldiers and these temple police would leave with a glimpse and an understanding that this wasn't just a man. Who are they seeking? So verse 7, Jesus asked them again, "Whom do you seek?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." So just read between the lines, right? See it like a human. He asked them a question again, and you can imagine just bracing up, clenching your weapons. But this time Jesus withholds his power in this moment. He confirms his identity again, maybe again causing them to brace up before he goes on to say, "So if you seek me, and let these men go." He's who they want, not the disciples. But even more than that, in this moment, he's in control. He's willing to go along with what they've come out to do. And for his disciples, for his followers, again, he's the good shepherd. He protects them. He says, "You came for me, so take me. Let these men go." And it points to just what he said back in chapter 10 and even in John chapter 17, that he's not going to lose any of them. So let's zoom out for a second. Thus far, both Judas and the Jewish religious leaders, they've found a common enemy and a common threat in this man, Jesus. He jeopardizes them, right? Their power, their position, their personal aims. So they sinfully conspire and collaborate together in an effort to preserve themselves and to maintain the status quo. They've got a common enemy. Listen, brothers and sisters, what do you do with your faith in the moment that Jesus' will and Jesus' way doesn't match your personal aims? What do you do? What happens when Jesus places himself in the way of your self-preservation by calling you to deny yourself? What happens when Jesus places himself in the way of your quest for power or your holding on to power by calling you to lose everything for him? What happens when he places himself in the way of your status and calling you to be the least, a servant? What's your response? Do you attempt to change him and to modify what he's saying? To adjust yourself and to sort of work yourself around what he's actually calling you to do and denying yourself, becoming the least and following him? Do you outsource your desires to other people and other things that promise us hope or power or status? Do we take matters into our own hands? See, what Judas displays here is what every one of us will face as we encounter Jesus and as his will and his way and his mission converges with ours. What are you seeking? Who are you seeking? Who do you desire? Who do you love? Again, as Steve prayed earlier, if we're honest, we will all acknowledge that we have chosen ourselves over Jesus more times than we'd even care to admit. We have chosen ourselves. That's what makes us like Judas. I love the lyrics to the song that King's Kaleidoscope sings, "What have we done? Oh my God, what have we done? We've destroyed your son. Judas sold you for 30, I'd have done it for less." That's us. That choosing of ourselves, the quest for self-preservation and self-protection, for the pursuit of our own fame, our own name, our own power, our own will, that's at the foundation of every single sinful thought, intent, and action in this world. It's the lie that the serpent whispered to Eve in the garden. You'll be like God. Surely you won't die. Choose you. Protect, preserve you. Let's move on. We'll see the next thing here. The Judas's quest to preserve himself has diverted his path from Jesus through betrayal. He's fled from Jesus by betraying him. But now there's another response here in this garden that's a diversion from Jesus' way and his mission as well. Again, Judas, we could say, encounters Jesus' difficult, complex, and unconventional way and responds in flight from Jesus. But Peter, in this moment of watching Jesus be taken by the authorities, he encounters Jesus' unconventional way and he responds with fight. Look at verse 11. Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. That servant's name was Malchus. Peter's ready to fight. I listen to hip-hop. Pop the trunk. Get the strap. Let's do it. Put yourself in Peter's shoes for a moment, brothers and sisters, right? Peter, what are you doing, man? Come on, man, really? Put yourself in his shoes. The authorities, the police, a mob of fully armed police led by a colleague and a close confidant comes to your spot to secretly arrest your leader. The injustice that Peter is feeling that's boiling in his bones right now. The system has come out against Jesus, against them. But the betrayal. Seriously, Judas? You came with a mob? You came with the very guys Jesus was rebuking? The very ones Jesus said would hate them. You've joined them. And also remember, Simon the Zealot is there. You don't know, this guy sees Roman officers and soldiers and anything Roman. He's ready. He is ready. So Peter's like, forget diplomacy and civility. No, this is past that. This is beyond that now. These actions are unjust. So Peter's probably thinking, I'm going to take justice into my own hands. Jesus better not go with them. Jesus, you're not going with them today. Now's the time to fight. Now's the time to overthrow this corrupt system. Look how they're showing themselves as evil. To strike, Peter thinks. And so with all the rage that he can muster and with all the might that he can muster, Peter strikes. He strikes. Now Jesus condemns Peter's actions. But this unrighteous anger, this place where Peter comes from, yeah, he has a right to be angry. He has a right to be livid. But it's deeper than that. It's deeper than that. Peter strikes from a place of loyalty to Jesus. He wants to defend Jesus. He wants to show strength for Jesus. That's what's most important to him. But even in this, he wants to keep Jesus from Jesus' plan and his mission, which is why Jesus says in verse 11, Peter, put your sword in its sheath. This is bigger than that. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? The Jewish leaders are wrong. The Roman soldiers there, they're all committing injustice. But there's someone behind their wicked actions. And that is the Father's plan and purposes. And this is what Jesus sees, even as he now becomes the victim of unjust actions. God's in control. God's in charge. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? So let's zoom back on Peter. He's the same guy who back in John chapter 13, 8, Peter will not fathom Jesus to lower himself enough to wash his feet. He's about displays of strength and power. You will never wash my feet, he says. You will never take the lowest position of a slave and a servant and do that for me. No, I have too much esteem and regard for you. I want to show people that this is how you should be seen, as great, as a king, as a ruler, as a leader. Power, powerful displays. You shall never wash my feet. And in John chapter 13, verse 37, Peter goes on to vow to lay his life down for Jesus. Jesus, you talking about you're going to die? No, I will die for you. You said you're going to lay your life down for the sheep? Nope. Cool, Jesus, thanks. I'm going to lay my life down for you. And now here, Peter's trying to prove that. He's trying to prove that by keeping Jesus from being arrested. Listen, brothers and sisters, he's really no different from Judas. Jesus has explained in clarity his mission to suffer and to die. How this is God's will and God's plan. That the events that will take place over the next several hours, they're meant to happen. This is why he has come. But again, when those plans converge with Peter's plans for Jesus, with Peter's perspective of who Jesus is and who Jesus should be, instead of fleeing like Judas, he fights. He fights to keep Jesus from pursuing God's will and God's plans. To Peter, Jesus shouldn't be arrested. Jesus shouldn't die. So that's where this reaction is coming from. And when Jesus' path continues to lead down the road of suffering, death, shame, and what looks like defeat, what looks like loss, what looks like weakness, Peter will go from fighting for Jesus here to fleeing from Jesus and denying him. Can he be associated with that? He's all for strength and power, for victory, a victorious Christianity. But can he lean into loss? Can he take up his cross and die and deny himself? Can he actually believe Jesus for what Jesus says about himself? Or will he continue to hold on to this ideal of Jesus that isn't who he really is? Peter will go from fighting for Jesus to fleeing from him by denying him. So brothers and sisters, let's see these men as humans who are just like us, complex, complicated, sinful, messy. Let's read them as humans. They don't get to this place overnight. They don't get to this place in a few hours. A switch wasn't flipped that caused Judas to betray Jesus. This was no Jedi mind trick. Satan actually entered into Judas, yes. But Judas has been in his body the entire time with his sinful and complicated motives and perspectives and thoughts about who Jesus is and who Jesus should be and what he thinks this means for Jesus and for him. Following his way even as he is following Jesus, thinking that Jesus is going the same way that he is. Again, creating his own version of Jesus. Willing to follow him until Jesus takes a different turn that jeopardizes Judas's priorities. What we see here is that this is a gradual trajectory to betrayal. And betrayal here was only the fruit of a heart that was rooted in its own self-promotion and self-preservation. We are all capable of the exact same thing. When this desire to preserve ourselves at all costs, to promote ourselves at all costs, to be sovereign over our own lives, to sit on the throne of our hearts and to say mine rather than God, it'll lead us to these kind of responses. This is what sin does. It takes you where you do not want to go. This was only the fruit of a heart that was rooted in its own self-promotion and preservation. That's what Judas was seeking. And he sought it even while following Jesus. Let this be a sober kind of warning to us, brothers and sisters. That's why it is important for us to behold Jesus, to see Jesus for who he says he is, and believe Jesus. Because our hearts want to make him someone else. They want to make him something else. They want to corruptly and wickedly take Jesus and sign him up for our agendas. Sign him up for our priorities. Get him to co-sign on our will to be done and not his will. And we see Peter as well. Again, this man who claimed that he followed Jesus even to his own death. A man who showed unflinching loyalty to him. Who said he'd die for Jesus. And look, he almost went through with it. But he was going to do this in an effort to preserve and protect his own idea of Jesus. He did everything in his power, even responding by committing violence, so that his ideals and his hope could be preserved. Peter was seeking a strong Jesus. But when the way of Jesus leaned into weakness and suffering and even death, when Jesus leaned into death and apparent defeat, Peter fought and eventually fled. Brothers and sisters, what are you seeking? Both of these men would not have Jesus to be who he said he would be. Where are we like these men? Where have we conformed Jesus into our wills, into our desires, instead of following him, even at the cost of our own self-preservation, following him into death, into loss, into suffering? Where are we refusing to follow Jesus because it conflicts with what we value and prioritize? Listen, I'll close here. What's interesting is, but not coincidental in Peter's case, if you keep looking, is why does John include this name here, Malchus? Probably the lowest of the low here. He's a servant of the high priest. He's the guy who gets coffee and the guy that the high priest sends to go do his dirt, which is exactly why he's here. Why does John even include this name? Why do we care? Why should we care who Malchus is? He gets his ear cut off. We know in other gospels, Jesus heals him and puts his ear back on. This dude's not even on the right side of history here. It's interesting because in looking to defend Jesus by striking Malchus, this servant, the lowest of the low in this crowd, Peter actually struck a servant whose name means king. The name Malchus means king. And I don't know, maybe John means to include this here for this reason or not, but this is exactly what would take place here in this moment. God's servant, who is king, would be struck by the hands of sinful men. And he will also drink the cup of sin's punishment. He will bear the punishment and the penalty for sin in himself that everyone in this world deserves. It's a picture of something that echoes larger. What Jesus will do. How he will be struck and everybody, the sheep will scatter. The shepherd will be struck and the sheep will scatter. But in his service, in his taking the form of a servant, he's really king. And for all who follow him in this way of suffering and death and loss, denying ourselves, taking up our cross, and following Jesus into death, his taking our death on himself, his bearing our punishment, our dying to sin, turning from sin, by going down into death with Jesus in what looks like defeat, we will be raised to life with Jesus because death will not hold him. He will be raised in life forever. And by denying ourselves, by setting aside our self-preservation, by turning from our sin and pursuing sovereignty over our own lives and following Jesus in this way, when his mission converges with ours, with us and our wills, when we submit ourselves to him and say, your will be done and not mine, we move to the path of life, to forgiveness, acceptance, joy, because we see Jesus for who he really is. The one who will be killed and who will die, but who will also be raised from death 3 days later. Let's not prevent him. Let's not flee. Let's not fight. But let's put faith in him and trust him with our own lives, whatever it may cost, because he's in control. I am he, Jesus says. We turn from our sin and to trust in Jesus. Let me pray for us.